I'm Tom O'Connell, and I'm talking about Robert Frost's poetry with you. This is the second session. The first one we started off yesterday was talking about humor, and we'll continue talking about his humor today. We'll also perhaps move on to the next stage, which is how he worked, how he thought about poetry, what he did to create the wonderful poems that we're able to share together today and the rest of this week. I said that one aspect of his poems, his humor, was very Yankee. He was quintessentially your Yankee, your New England upstate farmer type. He carried a kind of twang, the upper New England twang. There's a story of the New Englander who was on a roof. A friend of mine actually told me this happened to him. And it was a day like today. The afternoon was just glorious with blue sky, golden kind of day. And this fellow said to his neighbor up on the roof, he said, "My goodness, isn't this a lovely day?" And the man on the roof said, "Hey, yeah, we'll catch hell for this." That's a very Vermont kind of humor. Frost loved that kind of humor. He loved that kind of phraseology. The exactitude of those words shows an "aya," two syllables, "aya, we'll catch hell for this." Let's look at a couple of the other short poems in the handout. I had a handout yesterday that I gave to some of you. By the way, I also said that I've got some of these columns that I wrote about Frost, which is in effect a kind of book review, which I'll leave here in case any of the rest of you want to pick them up at the end. let's just pass these around. This is a few poems that were not in the Untermeyer book that I have for... I have suggested to the bookstore that they put on sale for you. There are other Frost books, but this is the one that I'm concentrating on, and I'm doing it for you students because I know students are always poor, right?
I think they ran out of those and they put this big one out.
Okay, so they ran out of these. Huh? Well, I'm glad to see that you're eating them up, that they're moving fast.
These are 10.
These are 10. Well, that's pretty reasonable for that book. That's really a heck of a book. And that's got almost all the poems that I'll be talking about. But I'll use the pagination in this one simply because this is the one that I prepared. But they're fairly easy to find. Let's take a look, though, first, even before we come to this book, which is the Untermeyer Robert Frost Poems, to a couple more which are in the handout, which I've just passed around. Let's look at a couple of these that are pretty short and that have some nice humor to them. Let's look at page 3, the top poem, 2 lines. Somebody want to read that for us? Somebody want to read it aloud for us? Share it with us.
"The Secret Sits," that one?
Please. Mm-hmm.
"We dance round in a ring and suppose, but the secret sits in the middle and knows."
What's the secret? "We dance round in a ring and suppose, but the secret sits in the middle and knows."
Sounds like a riddle.
Sounds kind of like the riddle, doesn't it? Do you have any clues as to what it might be?
He has a capital S there.
Puts a capital S there. Very good. What do you think he would put a capital S there for?
Could be divinity.
Yeah. Yeah, Larry. Could be divinity, couldn't it? Could be divinity. Could be another way of saying God. Not quite so direct, a little more oblique.
Again, he could be talking about the end of life and the life hereafter, too.
Related, perhaps, to the deity.
That's the secret.
Yeah, the secret, the end is something that has the information that you and I don't have. So it's a kind of play on words, it's a kind of a puzzle, it's a kind of a riddle to make us think a little bit. Therefore, it has a nice edge of humor. It's kind of surprising the way he's got it. The rhyme scheme is so simple. the words suppose and knows. Nice simple little rhyme, just trills right off your lips, no trouble at all, and yet provocative. It's provocative. Yes.
Like the Rubaiyat, he that tossed thee down into the field, he knows about it all. He knows.
Good, good analogy, right. Which brings it further to thinking about it as the deity, doesn't it? Yeah.
Does he usually refer to God as a quiet, hidden, silent type God? Is that his usual reference to God?
I would say it's usually oblique. It's usually not head on. He doesn't talk about God, G-O-D, any more than he talks about love, L-O-V-E. And yet almost all his poems have some flavor of love in them. And many of them have connotations of God as well. He tends to like to be a little more indirect. That's very New England, you see. It's very New England not to want to be direct, not to head on with the topic that you're hinting at. You remember I mentioned yesterday the story about John. That brief quote about John. John's dead. He died yesterday. He didn't want much to say about it. Doesn't want to talk about death. You know, if he wants to be talked about his death, he wants it to be, well, he was a nice fellow. Wasn't he a nice fellow? Wasn't John a nice fellow? John would accept death, but he didn't want to talk about something as heavy as death, at least not in terms of death. He'd talk about it in some other terms. New England is great for using all the euphemisms about death, such as passed on, passed away, all those kinds of phrases that we use to keep from talking about the head-on phrase, John's dead, which is so funny. John wouldn't want to talk about that. Let's look at the next one, an answer. An answer. Somebody want to read that one first? After you've had a chance to look at it. Sharon, you want to try it?
But islands of the blessed, bless you, son. I never came upon a blessed one.
But islands of the blessed, bless you, son. I never came upon a blessed one.
Again, he's got the capital.
Yeah, island of the blessed is in caps. What do you think he's talking about there? And as I mentioned yesterday, usually you can't just say X equals X. It's X equals maybe A and B, or maybe it's possibly, it's conceivably, it's there's a possibility of what he was thinking of. Remember his obliqueness. So what might the metaphor be for islands of the blessed, do you think? Or islands of the blessed?
Maybe privilege.
The privileged class?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And yet, if it were just islands of the privileged class in the materialistic sense, then he might very well have seen them. He moved around a bit.
Again, he must be referring to the deity of capitalism. Maybe what he's saying is that instances of God in action in the world, etc., are not something he's seen signs of. The world's harsh, and no one helps anyone.
Yeah, the ideal world where everybody is indeed Christian to everybody else, loving his or her neighbor, he's been looking around for some time, but he's never found one. Have you? Have you ever found an island of the blessed? Holden Village accepted. We'll talk about Holden Village for the moment. But even Holden Village, maybe once in a while we'll see a little interaction between people. Spouses, heaven forfend. Fathers and sons, fathers and daughters, mothers and their children that aren't quite ideal. Sir?
Having lived in the paradise of the Pacific for a while, I think we'd be sorry we didn't get to Hawaii.
Might be close. On the other hand, those of you who've lived in Hawaii, and I haven't, I shouldn't wonder, found that there may be an occasional little glitch in the ideal paradise that Hawaii is. Maybe one day out of 50 it's too hot, perhaps, or
traffic
or something. Maybe there's a little traffic, maybe there's a little air pollution, maybe there's something.
Even a little crime.
Yeah, maybe there's some crime even. Yeah, so, islands of the blessed. Oh, bless you, son. I never came upon a blessed one. One of the things that I love about this poem is that the three meanings of blessed, the three vernacular meanings that we put on things. Island of the blessed, if we say it, would be paradise, would be the perfect place, would be, let's say, San Juan, St. Thomas, St. Croix. Those places come pretty close to being ideal in the sense of climate, beauty, etc. And yet, there's a lot of racial inequality. There's a lot of racial prejudice. There's a lot of unsettling kinds of social phenomena that take place on those islands, particularly if you look closely and particularly recently. So they're not ideal. Then bless you, son, the use of bless as a quasi-religious kind of greeting. Bless you, son. Bless you, son, in the sense of I can't quite be responsive to your request, but what I can do is say to you, may God bless you, a very Christian kind of a salutation, a statement to a kid. I never came across of, now blessed means something quite different, doesn't it? What could be a synonym for the blessed in the last use? A single one. It could even be something like doggone. I never saw a doggone one. Yeah, never saw, we could even get stronger, a little more emphatic phrase. You can even say, never saw a damned one. Never saw a damned one. But blessed is a softer way to say it, and yet it has that kind of, oh, I never saw a doggone one. Never saw one. Okay, we've got a couple of other short ones here. I love these short ones because they're so provocative. And if you look at them and think about them, you'll see more and more things. Let's look at Pertinax there in the middle of page 2. We're getting a little away from humor on this one, it seems to me. It's not quite as directly, doesn't tickle your funny bone, but it has such a nice play on words that it may be humorous. Somebody want to read that for us?
Let chaos storm, let cloud shapes swarm, I wait for form.
Okay.
Candy.
I wait for form. What do you suppose he means by that?
Explain the title.
Pertinax. Pertinax. I'm not sure I know.
Maybe that's a word made up of pertinent syntax.
Something like that. I realize I don't. I'm not quite sure.
Pertinent axiom or something?
Something like that, yeah.
What did you say that for?
Pertinent axiom.
Pertinent axiom? Mm. It's not really an axiom. Pertinax. I don't know the word pertinax. Good question. Let chaos storm, let cloud shapes swarm, I wait for form. This is a kind of good introduction to our talk about how he worked, by the way, because...
It just occurred to me when he was looking at this that here is a poet sitting in his room looking out the window trying to come up with something, and there's a storm out there, and he's really sitting there waiting for some form on paper to flow out of that. Mm-hmm. That's what I thought of.
Mm-hmm.
Oh!
Yeah, he waits for the muse to strike him, which will then give him a form in which he can put things. He one time said, whoever has learned the virtues of form is never again subject to the full impact of the awful excruciations that life brings on us. If you've got a form... got a form, then you're able to deal with whatever comes your way. So form might be religious, mightn't it? A form of paying attention to our own minuteness, to our own inability to hold. Maybe he's talking about religion there. But he's also talking about his art, I feel sure. What else might he be saying? Anybody have any other ideas? Remembering
why death? Why all this trouble? Chaos? No reason. What's the reason? No, everybody always says, why did this happen to me?
So one response to that, which might be a religious response, might be a response related to form as religion, might it not? Because God wills it. That might be an answer, right? Or it might be it all equals out. Your troubles will pass and everything will be better. If you have as your form, and some people I think do, it'll all even out. Luck and bad luck, good luck and bad luck evens out. That's a kind of form, isn't it? To say, wait, and things will turn. That's a consolation we often bring to people who have trouble. Better days will come. All those cliches we use to comfort people are a kind of form, aren't they? Okay, let's see, a couple more in here. Let's look at Wright's biplane up above. I love this one. The Wright's biplane. And remember that Frost was living at a time, and was a mature person at a time, when the Wrights first flew. Wonderful new biography of the Wrights, by the way. Great new book, which I have not yet read. I've heard it read on the radio, but maybe some of you have. I'm going to get it and read it myself. Wrights are fascinating. Somebody want to read this about the poem, about their plane? Please, Larry.
This biplane is the shape of human flight. Its name might better be First Motor Kite. Its maker's name, time cannot get wrong, for it was written in heaven, doubly right.
Now we come upon the twinkly-eyed fey joker that Frost loved to be, and that he often is in his poems interspersed with more serious thoughts. Okay, this is an admiring poem for the Wrights, whom he did greatly admire, that kind of creativity. This biplane is the shape of human flight. But then he puts it down a little bit, because looking at it back from our own time, it does indeed look more like a kite. Those of you who have seen pictures of it, you say, my goodness, it's just like the kites that were flying up on the tailings the other day, right? It looks more like that than it looks like a jumbo jet. And then he comes to this wonderful play on words, double entendre, pun, with respect to the name and the fact that there are two of them. See, so he's got a kind of a couple of things coming at us here with respect to the humor, which makes it even more surprising and therefore even cuter, even funnier. Its maker's name, time cannot get that wrong. The implication is time does get some things wrong, but time can't get that wrong. For it was writ in heaven, doubly right. Because there were two of them, Orville and his brother. Okay, let's take a look at another one here on our handout.
I suppose that has another pun there with double U for Wilbur, right?
Yeah, maybe. Good for you. Yeah, good for you. Yeah, you always find things in Frost that you didn't know were there. He was always pleased. He was always pleased when people did find things. Right? I said yesterday to some people, Larry, that when somebody came up with something like that, Robert, did you put that in there? He said, no. Nope. But if you found it there, it's yours. No charge. No charge. Let's take a look at provide, provide. Now we're getting at a different kind of humor, maybe. Provide, provide. This one's a little longer. Why don't I read this one, just because I've read it before. The witch that came, the withered hag, to wash the steps with pail and rag, was once the beauty Abishag. The first poem in the handout. The picture pride of Hollywood, too many fall from great and good for you to doubt the likelihood. Die early and avoid the fate or if predestined to die late, make up your mind to die in state. Make the whole stock exchange your own. If need be, occupy a throne where nobody can call you crone. Some have relied on what they knew, others on simply being true. What worked for them might work for you. No memory of having starred atones for later disregard or keeps the end from being hard. Better to go down dignified with boughten friendship at your side than none at all. Provide, provide. Okay, this is a provocative poem. Right. What do you think about it? You think it's funny? Our subject is humor. Is it funny?
Some parts of it are.
Yeah. Which parts did you find that made you?
The witch that tamed the wizard hag is a funny line. And then when it says she was once the beauty Abishag, picture pride of Hollywood, you sort of get a funny thing on that, because you can imagine that a beautiful person called Abishag, who was the picture pride of Hollywood, would be... is a sort of funny concept. You imagine her as being glamorous and curly hair and old-fashioned.
And she once was, and she's up there on the silver screen, and you can see her on your television set when they show old movies, but she doesn't look quite that way anymore, apparently. What are your other thoughts about this, about the possible humor in it?
Well, there's like... seems to be a sharp irony.
Yeah, I think there is, right.
So in a sense there's humor. If you're saying one thing and meaning another, that's usually, or can be humor.
Mm-hmm. What's he really meaning, do you think, Larry?
Well, I think he's issuing a criticism of the way people rush about and use money and prestige to provide for themselves, and suggesting with irony that there's something deeper about life that you should be concerned about than providing for yourself with bought in friendships or fame or fortune or wealth.
Yeah, right. Got an interesting line though in the middle of that. Everybody says, some have relied on what they knew. Others on simply being true. What worked for them can work for you.
What worked for them might work.
What might work for them might work for you. Right. Much better. Might work. What's he getting at there, do you think? I mean, I think Larry's right on the right track. He's obviously, it's a kind of a reductio ad absurdum of providing for your future, and that you can do it in very controlled fashion, like insurance, like buying friends, so that they'll be looking after you when you're old and gray.
He's implying, it seems, as you just implied, perhaps, that the being simply true is a much better way to make friends than being the Hollywood starlet, sort of. Glamour, one gets the feeling at least that might work as it has for some.
Yeah. Is that a good motivation for being true? Is he saying?
Mm-hmm. He's also saying that there is no guarantee that it will. I mean, it's like what I always think of when I read that, those lines is, a faithful wife who would be dumped by her husband toward the end of their lives for a younger woman or something. She was true. And then he says it might work for you, but there's no guarantee in there that faithful wife is going to be rewarded. Or someone who's worked in a factory for 30 years and then the factory shuts and they don't have any livelihood. You know, I don't think you can plan as a guarantee, even if you're true.
I think he says there are no guarantees. I mean, it's like it keeps getting more and more serious, and then he says, you know, no memory of having starred or tones for their disregard, or keeps the end from being hard. It seems to me that that's the line. That the end is going to be hard. And you can do what you will, but you don't have a lot of control over what's going to happen at your end.
Yeah. I think that's right on. You can't be sure. You can't count on it. Anyway, it seems to me he's saying obliquely, again, he doesn't come right at you, but it seems to me saying, that's not the reason for being true. And that's not the reason for learning. You don't learn. You don't go to college. You don't go to school. You don't study books in order to cram your head so that when you're, 60, 70, 80, you're secure. That's not a good reason. People do it for that. People do it for that reason, but I don't think he's necessarily condoning that. He's saying that's not the reason. He's implying. It's implying. It's all by implications. We are perhaps to infer that, hey, you be true to other people because that's the right way to be. He's not being moral. He's not saying that, but it seems to me it's there. There are other reasons for being true. That's not the reason for being true in order to keep the end from being hard.
Well, remember, to thy own self be true.
Yeah.
You do it for yourself, so you feel good about yourself.
Right.
And you apply the golden.
Yep.
Isn't he really saying, though, with the irony of this whole poem, saying that as life winds down and my ages, it becomes hard? And that's the way it is. It doesn't matter if you're the king or if you own everything or if you're the Hollywood star or if you bought a lot of friends, it's still going to be hard.
Yeah, even if you are true.
Right.
And even if you're the smartest guy in the world.
Knowledgeable, whatever. He's using irony all the way down. If you read this literally, what he's really saying is you should buy a lot of people to be at your side as you get older. And I'm not sure he really means that.
No, that's right. That's right. You come to that conclusion as you're kind of working your way through the meaning, but then what you do is you stop at the end of the poem and you say, hey, wait a minute. Hey, that can't be it. There's got to be another thing that he's saying here, and what he's saying is not all that clear, except that this is not the right approach. What is the right approach? Well, read on. Read other poems. Maybe I'll tell you. If I wanted you to know that in this poem, I'd have told you. Is what he said when people said, well, did you mean this? Did you mean that? If I wanted you to know what I meant, I'd have told you what I meant.
Is he reflecting any prejudice toward women?
I don't know. Do any of the women find any prejudice against women in here? Don't find it myself. I think that he's talking about almost anybody. It could be a male movie star. I think he just kind of liked the idea of her beauty and the transformation of her into a withered hag who's washing the steps. But he could have picked Robert Redford or Rudolph Valentino.
Robert
at the same
Redford
time.
Will never be ugly.
Well, that's a pretty dogmatic.
Truly though, there's this thing about, and there are a lot of actors that even up until their end, they still look dignified, gray, silvery hair, and not all of them, but a lot of them still may.
Yeah, the ones who are.
The women, of course, once they get to a certain age, they just. I'm just saying this. What society's, image of beauty and all that has to do with young women, but older men can get silver hair.
Yes, I see what you're saying. But on the other hand, it does seem to me that those men that you're citing, Charlton Heston or John Forsythe, are people who continue to be really fortunate in their careers. But I bet you for every one of them, we could find, if we wanted to, go looking, somebody who used to be a handsome leading man who today looks like heck.
Oh, yeah.
He's terrible in his appearance. It's just, he's dissipated. He's, all kinds
some
of ugly things could happen to him. Yeah. Right.
But not Robert Redford.
Just pick the wrong example.
Many of them choose to die early and avoid the fate, all of them.
Yeah, that's right.
Hey, there you are.
I think maybe this is a fairly straightforward piece, which means what it says, which is die early and avoid the fate, because getting old in America or getting old period is no fun. Or if you're predestined to die late, make up your mind to die in state. Because it's no good the other way. It's no good being or having your body fail you, or having your friends fail you. So no memory of having started tones for later disregard, or keeps the end from being hard. I think he's made means what he says. It's no good getting old. He was, it may have been a passing mood, may not have been the way he felt all the time, but I don't see any argument in the poem against that.
I guess what I would find in the poem against that is the very obviousness of that. And I can't see Frost being quite that heavy-handed and obvious.
Maybe, I mean, he does, when he says provide, twice at the end, with an exclamation point there, a little bit of overstatement, but he's going to be undignified than none at all.
But then the last two lines, oh, you almost can't say those last two lines without saying, provide. And then you say, provide what? Well, let's see now. I guess I better save my money. I guess I better maybe buy some friends. Say if I pay you $1,500 a year, will you write me every day? And my buddy in case of need and that sort of stuff. Yeah, that's what I'll do. I'll pay each of you $1,500, okay?
Oh, no, you give fancy parties that we come to.
Okay, that's your price, is it?
You got me and you.
Hey, Sharon, I'm going to give her $1,500 a year. She's going to write me nice letters, and when I'm sick, she's going to come see me.
Provide means take care.
Yeah.
So be careful, take care, which I do think means that at the end is going to be very difficult. I mean, that you don't have a lot of control, and and this too may happen to you, no matter what your stance in life is.
May have.
So Tom, your argument is that because he so overstates his case, that he's arguing the opposite. But he doesn't say what he's arguing.
Yeah, that he doesn't say that he's arguing, and that there are subtleties operating here, and it's just so obvious that one thing that's left out of the equation, except you pick me up on the might, one thing that's left out of it is that great, huge item of luck. Good luck. Abishag, after all, is lucky, in a manner of speaking, because she's still alive. How old is Abishag? Let's say she's 75? Shall we just say she's 75? She's a pretty senior person. A lot of her contemporaries aren't around even to have the pleasure of
washing the steps,
getting mad at the way things are. So the question of luck is absent here. You can't really provide. There's an element of luck that's there that you can't handle. So it seems to me it's a more profound poem in suggesting that, hey, what it's going to be like, folks. It may be that dying late, dying early and avoiding the fate is the way to go, and yet I can't believe you really felt that way, even at a moment. Maybe so, though.
I think it's a case of how the mighty have fallen.
Oh, with Abishag, for sure. The lines of this poem that are in my head, somehow I think of them a lot, are the ones about atonement. No memory of having starred, atones for later disregard, or keeps the end from being hard. Right? Okay, let's...
I'm going to give Ingrid an A. Are you going to give her an F?
I reserve the right to defer my judgment until the class is over. I may give a quiz, and it may be part of the grade, may be in the quiz, right?
Okay. I appreciate it.
Can't tell. Let's look at Fire and Ice. Fire and Ice. On page 242 in the book. We're now moving to the book. Now moving to our text, and those of you who have the other text are going to be able to find it in, I think, in the last, in our book.
There's an index in there.
In our book, it's on page 242. That is to say, when I say our book, I mean this one. I'm using a previous edition that I mentioned to folks yesterday, because this is one I've had marked up when I've taught for us before. Fire and Ice. Somebody want to read this for us? Fairly straightforward.
I'll read it. I love this poem too. Some say the world will end in fire, some say in ice. From what I've tasted of desire, I hold with those who favor fire. If it had to perish twice, I think I know enough of hate to say that for destruction, ice is also great and would suffice.
Okay. What do you think? How's the world going to end? Fire or ice?
Bible says fire.
Bible says fire. Okay.
Cosmologically, it's fire.
Cosmologically, it's fire. Okay, that's the world. That's
fire.
The scientist speaks. But are we listening just to science here? Some say the world will end in fire, some say in ice. What I've tasted of desire, I hold with those who favor fire. But if I had to perish twice, I think I know enough of hate to say that for destruction ice is also great and would suffice. So around the two words, fire and ice, we have clustered a whole bunch of other things, don't we? For example, the most obvious one is ice. From what I've tasted of desire, I hold with those who favor fire. The fire of desire. The fire of desiring so much that you burn yourself up like Nero. Burn the city up. On the other hand... Pardon me?
Fire would be quicker.
Would fire be quicker? Depends upon how cold it got, I guess, huh? I guess I one time had an argument with somebody. I was in the Air Force, and I had an argument about if we flew high, really high as we could, and our plane didn't have much capacity, we went up to about 35,000 feet, and that was about as high as we could go when I was flying. Would we first freeze, or would we get out of the orbit of the sun's rays, of the protection of the earth, to the point where the sun would burn us up like Icarus? The discussion never came out anywhere. We never really solved the problem, but that's one way to think about it. If you get up closest to the sun, as Icarus did, you remember, Icarus got up there so close to the sun that that burned his wings off and he fell to the earth. Whereas I think we know that if we go up high enough, what I've experienced going up that high was I better be darn sure to keep my electric suit on or I would freeze. Because it was awfully cold up there. Terribly, terribly cold. But this poem is really talking about in more metaphorical terms, isn't it? We're talking not scientifically. Scientist always tries to drive us back down into the world of matter of fact. The poet, on the other hand, is much more exalted. Is working in metaphor, much more profound. Of course, we all know that. We all know that the humanist is incomparably more provocative and profound than the scientist. Larry will come back at me when he thinks of something to say. Top me there. So it's. I think it's a funny poem. I think particularly it's funny because he says, "If I could perish twice." Twice,
yes,
I can see that that hate could come in. Hate could come in, and hate as ice is kind of interesting too, isn't it? Because you might think of hate as hot or cold. He thinks of it as cold.
Well, I think of ice as putting someone out of your circle, isolating someone, like solitary confinement. There are societies, and I can't think which one it is right now, that as punishment, the ultimate punishment is to completely ignore a person in their community. Disassociate entirely from that person, and the person just it's like being in hell, which is of course the opposite.
To freeze them out.
Freeze them out, right.
And freeze them out.
Their shoulder.
It happened to me once. I was the president of a college, and I was doing things the faculty didn't like, and they wouldn't speak to me. It was very hard. They put me in what they called Coventry. It was very hard. I've never talked about that until you said that. Because I didn't. One thing I did was I didn't talk about it. I ignored that it was happening. And eventually we worked our way through it. But it was very hard. So your point is really well taken. Yeah, it was extremely hard. Good point. The world might end that way. If we all stop talking to each other, even if Sharon stopped talking to me in spite of my $1,500 a month payment, maybe that would be the world would end, huh? Well, maybe if we all stopped, though, if you and I stopped talking to each other, nobody else would talk to you, and we lost all sense of communication, maybe that would be a form of the end of the world. Possible, huh?
Very
possible.
Yeah. Isn't that a very New England view of hate? To view hate as a cold, isolating, dispassionate thing compared to a hot, hate as a hot, fiery, fighting kind of engaging and explosive.
I guess it is. Mm-hmm. I guess it is, yeah. Mm-hmm. In New England or Northern Europe.
Right, Norwegian, I mean, I'm comfortable with that.
Yeah. I was going to say, in the Mediterranean, Greek or Roman, Sparta versus Athens, their hatred was passionate, fighting, fire. Whereas Northern hate, in some of Ingmar Bergman's movies, for example, where people hate each other, it's icy, isn't it? Or Ibsen's plays, the hatred is icy. So hatred can be either hot or cold, seems to me.
Well, I think in Moorhead, Minnesota, where I was raised, it tended to be cold.
Yeah, I suppose.
Not this summer.
I want to move, unless I want to offer the opportunity for anybody, though, who sees any poems, either in the handout, and the other ones eventually will come to, but maybe it'll be after some of you folks aren't able to join the class. Are there poems in the handout or in the book that you're particularly anxious that we have a look at? Sir?
I'd like to hear the wall.
Like to hear the wall. Okay, let's check the wall. Somebody help me find what page it's on in our book.
Is it the
mending wall, right, the mending wall. It's on page 94. Page 94. Would you like to read it for us, sir?
Try.
That would be nice.
Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen ground swell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun and makes gaps. Even two can pass abreast. The work of hunters is another thing. I've come after them and made repair where they have left not one stone on a stone. But they would have the rabbit out of hiding to please the yelping dogs. The gaps, I mean, no one has seen them made or heard them made, but at spring mending time we find them there. I let my neighbor know beyond the hill, and on a day we meet to walk the line and set the wall between us once again. We keep the wall between us as we go, to each the boulders that have fallen to each. And some are lobes, and some so nearly balds, we have to use a spell to make them balance. Stay where you are until our backs are turned. We wear our fingers rough with handling them. Oh, just another kind of outdoor game, one on a side. It comes to little more. There where it is, we do not need the wall. He is all pine, and I am apple orchard. My apple trees will never get across and eat the cones under his pines, I tell him. He only says, good fences make good neighbors. Spring is the mischief in me, and I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Why do they make good neighbors? Isn't it where there are cows? Near there are no cows. Before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out, and to whom I was like to give offense. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down, I could say. I could say elves to him, and it's not elves exactly, and I'd rather he said it for himself. I see him there bringing a stone, grasped firmly by the top in each hand, like an old stone savage armed. He moves in darkness, as it seems to me, not of woods only, and the shade of trees. He will not go behind his father, saying, and he likes having thought of it so well. He says again, good fences make good neighbors.
Good. Nice reading. Thank you. Thanks.
Down on that neighbor.
Yeah, and you got a nice little intonation there at the end there. It might be even a little more New England. Seems to me you got just a little too much R in the neighbors, if I make a correction. Because I think what Frost might say in that New England twang that he had was something like this. Good fences make good neighbors. Good fences make good neighbors. But you came awful close.
I spent only 2 weeks in New England.
One more week and you'd have had it. Well, what is this poem saying beyond the obvious statement about walls? You think?
Well, like the Berlin Wall, we all hate that wall.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think this is a wall that they love in a sense. It's my view that the good fences making good neighbors is the working together to achieve a common goal with his neighbor. It gives him a chance to also interact with his neighbors.
Mm-hmm. Maintaining the wall becomes a mutual activity that has a kind of affection in it, even though he's kidding his neighbor. They're obviously
sort of saying along the way that he really doesn't need the wall, he doesn't have a cow. But it's good to do this with his neighbors because they become better neighbors.
Yeah.
It says a lot about New England and the stones that just keep coming up, and you have to do something with them, and you make a wall because you plow the fields and the stones and the rocks are always there. And that's a good thing to do with them.
Mm-hmm. What is it, though, let me ask you, what do you think it is that doesn't love a wall and takes it down?
It can be maybe the barriers that come in between neighbors when there are walls. That could be what puts it down.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was his neighbor that liked the wall. Frost doesn't like the wall.
He doesn't really like the wall because he doesn't think it's necessary.
He thinks it's unfriendly.
Yeah, that's a good word, unfriendly, to have a wall.
I have a neighbor in my block who has two walls. One neighbor built a wall, and the other one built it right next to him. Each has their own wall. One of his neighbor's beauty.
Mm-hmm. Boy, that's interesting.
And he talks about his neighbors in Neanderthal. That image of the guy with the two big rocks in his hand. And,
yeah. So is that a put down of his neighbor? What were you going to say, sir?
I have a neighbor that just built a 6-foot picket wall on his side of the yard. And I asked him, I said, I feel like I'm in a stockade. Are you the cops and are we the robbers, or who's the Indians and who's the settlers, or what? And he explained, well, his daughters like to sunbathe out there and not have me watch.
It'll be interesting to see when his daughters grow up and move away, as daughters tend to do, if he'll take the wall down.
Well, one's only coming back once in a while already. But I thought of Frost when he put this thing up.
Yeah. Are walls unfriendly?
Sometimes.
This one is.
Certainly can be.
He says here about the neighbor, he says, he moves in darkness, as it seems to me, not of woods only and the shade of trees. He will not go beyond his father's saying. It's as if, you know, we've always done it this way, that the, you know, this guy just has this line, good fences make good neighbors. It's sort of generous on the part of Frost or whoever that speaker is to sort of enjoy the task once a year of putting the wall back up, but it's clear that, that the other guy is doing it out of a sense of wanting to keep him away,
mm-hmm.
wanting to keep him distant.
Mm-hmm.
And that he doesn't like that.
Yeah.
The speaker doesn't like that.
Yeah.
It inhibits our freedom. Remember the old cowboy song, Don't Fence Me In.
Do you think that the walls are a metaphor for something else?
Human relations.
Mm-hmm. I think maybe even the differences in, let's say, religious sects and things like that, institutions that define themselves so thoroughly that you've got to be this and you can't be anything else.
Uh-huh. Right.
There's no crossing over. Political parties, etc. Countries, nationalisms.
What would be the wall in terms of countries or nationalisms, Larry?
Well, in terms of politics, you know, in the United States, ideology versus communistic ideology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah? What even more concretely?
Mm-hmm.
Is an analogy of the wall as in you're talking about countries.
Well, the Berlin Wall. I mean, that's a
Berlin Wall would be one.
Mm-hmm. Any borders.
Any border. Any international border.
The Great Wall of China.
The Great Wall of China was built specifically because that's where they said, this is our turf, and we're building this so that we'll keep the barbarians out, and they may not pass this wall. So maybe what he's saying is Sharon's word there that she picked up, that the man moves in darkness because walls in the sense of international boundaries are now obsolete. Can you have realistic national boundaries if you have atomic bombs? Or even any kind of bombs where planes can fly over and bomb each other or shoot down airplanes?
Or spy planes.
Might it be that he's talking about an international metaphor here, that boundaries are are like walls, and something there is that doesn't like them wants them down, which is enlightenment, maybe?
It seems like there are two commonplaces that he's tussling with. Something there is that doesn't like a wall, and he repeats it. And good fences make good neighbors. And he sort of put those two things in juxtaposition and tries to sort out where he comes down on that. And I think he attributes the good fences make good neighbors to past. And the something there is that doesn't like a wall is more mystical. Elves, forces, powers. Sometimes the hunters, but it's a more varied attribution of what doesn't like the wall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The part is when he says he would like this man to say elves. He says, you know, it's not elves exactly, but I'd rather he said it for himself. Like he wants something in this man's heart to change, something in this man's spirit. But the man holds on to whatever it's from his past that has been doing walls for years.
Frost was a teacher. Spent a lot of his career as a teacher. And I see something of Frost in the teacher there in his dealing with the man. Spring is the mischief in me, and I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Mm-hmm. Why do they make good neighbors? That's a teacher's device, right? Mm-hmm. The Socratic advice, you ask a question. Why do they make good neighbors? Isn't where there's cows, where the cows might graze across? There maybe you do need a barbed wire fence. You don't need a stone wall there because cows find a way to get over the stone wall fence. Here there are no cows. Before I build a wall, I'd want to know what I was walling in or walling out. But the neighbor doesn't bite at all, the neighbor maybe is like we are as nations, saying, whoa, wait a minute, now here's our boundary. Come no farther. If you come farther, there's war. And maybe the fact that it's now way beyond the point where wars can be fought realistically over international boundaries. When we have a war over an international boundary, particularly in the Western world, we get so snarled up that we almost blow the world up, and next time we very well may. And therefore, maybe he's getting at the impracticality of walls as a solution.
It's a symbol, too, of the man coming with his repair rocks, and he compares him to it looking like a savage.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Uncivilized.
Uncivilized, coming to do something that used to work. It used to be effective for people to hunt and to survive by hunting, but we reached the point where that was no longer a realistic way for human beings to interrelate, and agriculture became a much better way of handling things, to just mention one transition. Maybe there has to be another transition of that sort. Well, there's one pretty obvious elf that people used to kid him about. What's the most obvious elf that might be involved here? It's clearly implied in line 2.
Nature.
Nature? What's the nature for
the harsh winters, the freezing and the snow.
What's the elf that's used for that? Jack Frost. People used to say, sure, something there isn't doesn't love a wall that sends the frozen groundswell under it. That's Jack Frost. Or maybe it was Robert Frost. So he used to say, yes, all right. Okay, if you want it that way, you can have it. So the final form is yours, no charge. But interestingly enough, he used to deny. He used always to deny. This is one of his most popular poems, as I think some of us know, that people always like to have him read. It's a provocative poem. It's a lovely poem. There has a lot happening, and it's fun. So he used to often be asked the kind of questions that we're asking here. Well, Mr. Frost, did you actually mean that these are international boundaries? And that was one of the cases where he'd answer, I didn't put it there. If you find it, you can have it. There's no charge. Or he would say, if I would have wanted you to know, I would have put it in the poem. He was very good at parrying questions, so he would never respond to questions about this, except he would say, well, maybe I'm being a little bit cute. That's about as far as he would go. He was a great one for mystery about what he put on paper. He didn't like to talk about his poems very much. He handled people who asked him questions very well. As I mentioned yesterday, I used to be his aide-de-camp when he came to Dartmouth College. So I watched him dealing with lots of different students. And I'll finish with the best exchange that I ever heard Robert Frost make was when a student was talking about the purpose of art. A lofty subject like the purpose of art would not be something that Robert Frost really liked to engage in, right? That's too direct. You've got to talk about it more obliquely than the purpose of art. Huh? When you say that, it's almost like provide. You've got to say, well, the purpose of art, folks, is as follows. Get your pencils out, I'm going to say it. A student said to him, well, Mr. Frost, surely all art is good as it prompts to action. And Frost thought a moment and he said, well, how so? And I'll close with that.